Joining us on the line now from the UK is PJ Vanston, who also writes songs and stories as Jem Vanston. He's the author of Crump, A Cat Called Dog and its sequel, and Santa Goes on Strike. He's been with us on the book show of quite a few times now. He's with us to talk about his latest book, something completely different, it sounds. It's called Somewhere in Europe, and it's a very timely and laugh-out-loud Brexit campus novel. Welcome to the book show, PJ.
Hi there, Hannah. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. And you?
Yeah, good. Nice and sunny in Swansea. That's the way we like to see it.
Oh, lovely. Enjoy. So it is. I mean, it's particularly timely, isn't it? But you wrote it a while ago.
Yeah, it's it came out earlier this year, but it actually was published in the same week as lockdown, when all the shops, everything closed on the 24th of March, and the book was published on the 28th of March. So that was great timing. I don't complain because there's so many other problems in the world, you know. But yes, it is actually a sort of sequel to my first ever novel, which was in 2010 called Crump. I mean, it's a standalone book, but it features the same character 10 years on.
Yeah, so tell us about that character.
Yeah, the character's Kevin Crump. He started off in the first book as a lecturer at a London university. And that was quite a successful campus satire that's actually sold out and did well, especially in the United States. It did well, became a set book in Scandinavia, in colleges. So it did, and it sold out, did rather well. And I thought now this is, it's 10 years on, and a couple of years I started thinking, well, you know, things have actually changed a bit in universities now. They're even more sort of politically correct and woke, and you've actually got people like banning books now at universities because they might trigger people, and there's a lot of no platforming. They're banning speakers like famous feminists like Germaine Greer because they might be offensive. And I thought, well, it's gone to another level now. And I thought, oh, okay. So I thought it's the right time to, with Brexit especially, and so much going on around that, I thought it's a perfect time to bring the character forward to 10 years, although I would stress you don't have to read the first book to enjoy this one. It's very much standalone. Mm. And to write a sort of state of the nation novel, and it's a Brexit novel, it's a campus novel. People have called it a lucky gem for the Brexit generation. But it is, ultimately, it's a comedy, it's funny.
Yes.
It's meant to be funny, but with a serious subtext, you know, there's serious. I mean, because when, you know, I never thought I'd live to see people banning books at universities. Somebody says they're offensive, or, you know, banning the great, you know, great sort of heroes of feminism or gay rights or things. They're banned from speaking because somebody calls them transphobic. And you've got to this kind of strange level now. I mean, I always call it a sort of mind virus that's come in from the United States, because this stuff started in U.S. universities, and it's come over here, you know, as I call it, a mind virus, which has kind of taken things to absurd levels, which, you know, are not tolerant or liberal. They're the complete opposite. You know, when you start banning books and banning speakers, banning opinions, all the rest of it, that's not liberal. That's not tolerant. That's the opposite.
No, it's political correctness gone mad, isn't it?
Well, it's gone mad and then some. I mean, the first novel dealt with political correctness gone mad. Now it's gone to some kind of surreal world, which I don't think most people agree with it. I mean, this is very much campus culture. You get it. The university in the book is totally fictional. It's set in South Wales, where I live, but it's totally fictional. And it's sort of representative of a lot of universities, because this is happening all over the place, this campus culture. And it's gone to such a level now, you just think that's got to be made up. And then you find out it's not made up. They're actually doing it. I mean, the book does actually predict. I mean, in the book, the local council decides, in support of Black Lives Matter, to take down all the statues of dead white men. So I sort of predicted that, you know, quite a few months before it happened. You know, and obviously I go a bit OTT with it, because it's fiction, it's satire, it's absurdist satire. But and now that's what the council has got a panel now in Swansea, where I live, deciding which statues will stay or go, and how they're going to deal with this, which I think personally is completely absurd. You know, I don't think any statue should be taken down. I think, you know, people shouldn't try and erase history by doing that.
That's the point, isn't it? It's history. This is things that happened in history, and bad things happened in history. We can't erase it.
You can't judge people also of the past by our own values.
No.
You know, if you can imagine in 50 years, people looking back at us will be condemning us for something or other. You know, and it was perfectly normal until the British banned slavery, of course. It was perfectly normal. And actually, I just found out the other day something very interesting. After 1807, the British banned it. African tribal chiefs sent delegations to London begging us to unban it because they were making so much profit out of it. So there is a very much an agenda here, which, to be honest, in U.S. universities has been going since the 1970s, which is sort of the sort of dead white men, DWM movement. And that's sort of grown and grown, and this is all part of that, I think. It's snowballed. But there's so many things now that are just, you know, they would seem absurd, but they're based on reality. In the book, for example, it's not a spoiler to say so, the local council decides to, the main character goes into a pub and he remembers that there were pictures of Welsh miners from 1920s on the wall, which you get here sometimes. And they've all gone, and he wonders where they've gone. And the pub's taken them down because somebody complained they were blackface, because the miners had come up from a shift in the pub and these old photos.
Gosh.
And so they'd sawn in their face. And people say to me, oh, that's so absurd, you're so over the top. Actually, that happened. That happened in Arizona. A bar owner had photos on his wall of Welsh miners from the 1920s, and of course, after their shift, they've got soot on their faces, and somebody complained, and out of fear, really, because he didn't want to be boycotted or brick through his window, he took them down. So, these things have happened. A lot of the things I mention have actually happened, insanely. And you think, you do wish they'd sort of focus on education rather than this nonsense.
Yes.
You do wish universities would. And anyway, you know, the whole basis, they use this word, a lot of people these days, and it's a very divisive society. Since Brexit, before Brexit, it's very divisive in the United States, and they haven't had Brexit. It's very divisive all over Europe. But people just cannot seem to tolerate anybody else's opinion anymore in the way that I remember they used to.
No.
In my lifetime. I mean, now it's sort of, people tend to live in an echo chamber, and social media makes this even worse, where you only sort of converse with people who agree with you. And the whole point of education, in a way, is being offended and, you know, being challenged. But you've got teachers at universities now who are frightened to do that, use the Socratic method of old, you know, the playing the devil's advocate. You've got tutors at universities frightened of making jokes in case somebody complains. Oh, I find that offensive. Those awful words you hear everywhere. I find that offensive.
People can be offended by anything, can't they? I mean, there's most things that people can find offence in these days.
Exactly. I was looking back the other day. I mean, if you think of all the great novels or great works of art or great songs in history, somebody's found them all offensive. Mm. People found the Beatles offensive. People found that, you know, every book. And, you know, you get people like Mark Twain, Huckleberry Finn. When he first published those in the United States, they were banned from libraries because they featured white people and black people getting along in the southern United States, okay? And now they're banned because, oh, apparently he uses Uncle Tom figures. And so you got the people, the same instinct is to ban from different sides of the political spectrum, which is very odd. I mean, I tend to generally be, I tend to think, well, apart from extreme things, don't censor anything. And certainly I think that universities, I mean, quite apart from the fact that the whole COVID thing has probably put about 15 universities in the UK on the verge of bankruptcy because they were so reliant on foreign students. Quite apart from that, you know, the university system is sort of digging itself into a hole, which makes it more and more remote from people. And also, you know, we desperately need people in certain professions in the UK. And yet they're worrying about this. You know, they should be worrying about providing people, well, giving people a good education for a start, but also, you know, serving society and serving the need for the various professionals. I mean, for example, about 80% of postgraduate science students are foreign and not British. Why is that? We don't have enough doctors here. We don't train enough. Why is that? You know, why can't people just think long term? The government, university managers. The problem is it's become like a business, really, universities. It's all about getting students in, and you get a fee, you paid for each student there. And, of course, you've got the cash cow international students coming in. And that seems to be the main focus of universities. You know, it's a huge subject, of course, universities. They're huge multi-million pound institutions. But, I mean, I think a lot of people now have realised, especially with COVID, and making people realize, well, why were you so reliant on so many foreign students coming in?
Yeah.
You know, why are you producing tens and hundreds of thousands of graduates in media studies every year and we're crying out for professionals and engineers and doctors and nurses and things like this. Well, why aren't you addressing that need in a, you know, long term, and start, instead of just thinking about how to get a fee out of a student in the next academic year?
Mm.
And I think, you know, things may change from COVID. A lot of things have changed. I mean, it's making a lot of people address a lot of things, of course, you know, because they've been forced to. But, you know, there will be changes in UK universities. A lot of them will merge. Some of them will, I know about 15 at least, are on the verge of going bust. So they will merge with others. And it's usually the lesser down universities.
Yeah.
But it's...
I have to ask you about the book. I want to get back to the book, Somewhere in Europe. So we've heard about Crump, the main character. What more can you tell us, without giving too much away, obviously, about the story and the other characters?
The main plot line of the book is that a university discovers in its founding document that it has the right to declare independence from the UK.
Okay.
And because the university is so anti-Brexit and pro-Remain, it decides to do just that in order to remain in the EU.
Hmm.
And, you know, Crump's got a job there and has to negotiate all this woke, political correct madness that's going on, as well as that, and the world's media turns up. And it's how he negotiates that, really, and how that progresses through the story reaches the conclusion, and hopefully is in a better place, but I won't give any spoilers.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, obviously, I come from a teaching background. I've been teaching for a while, but I used to teach English overseas and in the UK, and I taught a lot of people from a lot of different nationalities. So I can obviously draw on that in the a lot of the comic dialogue in the book. And somebody told me the other day, it's not just for people in education. I mean, people with that background will find it interesting, of course. But somebody I know from Facebook, actually, he's got a completely manual work background for working in factories. He said he was reading the book on the bus and he was laughing so much he had to get off because he didn't want to, you know, with a face mask, he didn't want to splutter on everybody. So I've been told the dialogue is just laugh out loud funny, because it's, and I draw on my experience with that and with I must have taught 50 different nationalities in my time. There's a couple of students in there. In the book, I think one Catalan, one Spanish, and so there's a lot of funny scenes like that. But again, there's a serious progression about how he's basically negotiating this this mad world he finds himself in, which even though the first book, the prequel, if you like, Crump from 2010, the university was mad enough then. Now he is shocked by how even more crazy it's all got.
Yes. Well, it sounds like great fun. It's called Somewhere in Europe, and it's by PJ Vanston, who we've been chatting to. Listeners can get a copy of the book from our website, tre.radio, in the bookshop section there. PJ, thanks so much for joining us.
Can I just say, I also arrange with this book that anybody should be able to buy it, to walk into any bookshop in the world and buy it or order it, and then it will be done print on demand in situ.
Okay.
That's what I've been told anyway. That's what I've arranged. I don't know if it works, but so anybody could walk in a bookshop in Spain, ask for the book, they can order it. It gets printed in Spain, uniquely for you there.
Great.
So that's, yeah, and it's online, of course, the usual online places.
Fantastic. PJ, thank you. Good luck with the book.
Thanks. It's been an absolute pleasure.